Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 30th, 2005. This session, Isaiah removes shoes and everything else. A Bible study of Isaiah 20, presented by Daniel Erlander in the Fireside Room. Disc number ERD 2005-12. Let's listen in.
Isaiah takes off his sandals and everything else. Before we start, though, I want to share a few things. At breakfast, we were talking about Walt Bowman. And how many of you ever heard him teach, preach, or studied under Walt Bowman? About half. He was one of the Holden saints that taught us so much. And I like to say he, very early in my ordained ministry, he taught me how to live grace fully. And then in his sermons just before his death, he taught me how to die gracefully. Mm-hmm. And so, but I want to tell a story we used to tell about Walt. And if you don't know Walt, he was a teacher for many years in systematic theology at Trinity Seminary in Columbus. And I think was at the Village way back. Karn and I shared with him at the Village in 1967. And we were so excited because he had a beard and was kind of liberal. So we really enjoyed him. But this story was told, Walt seldom ever exercised or did much physical activity. So the story was told that he was on the trail once by himself and ran into an angry bear, and no way of running fast enough to get away. So what he did was he knelt down on the trail and prayed. And then he opened his eye a little and saw the bear kneeling in front of him also praying. And then said, "Oh, good, a Christian bear." And he felt much better until he heard the prayer of the bear. Come, Lord Jesus. I want to give a tribute to Fred Niedner, who taught here at the beginning of the summer. And he brought with him a collection of little pithy sayings. So I'd just like to read some, then we'll get serious about Isaiah. Just these little pithy words of wisdom. Before you criticize someone, you should walk a mile in their shoes. That way, when you criticize them, you're a mile away and you have their shoes. Give a man a fish and he can eat two meals a day. Teach him how to fish, and he will sit in a boat and drink beer all day. And there is a fine line between hobby and mental illness. Then this is one. If there is no God, who pops up the next Kleenex in the box? I think you're enjoying this. If it's true we're here to serve others, what are the others here for? Why do buffalo wings taste like chicken? And then this is my favorite. Do you know about the Church of the Holy Frisbee? They believe, teach, confess that when you die, your soul goes up on the roof and you can't get it down. Oh. that's the beginning. I'd like to just share some things from yesterday when we talked about theophany, the God experience, as Moses had at the burning bush. Then I thought about how we talked about individuals having a experience of the presence of God in many ways, and I think communities do too. There are those times when people together have a sense of the mystery, and I have one remembrance of this we were at a church in San Diego, a struggling mission church in the early 70s. And the church was always short of money because there just weren't enough people. And so we used to hope someone rich would join the congregation that was a tither. Well, one Sunday in walks a new doctor in town and wife and beautiful children. And we just welcomed them with such enthusiasm and just opened our eyes to them, and they saw dollar signs. And then, the result of this welcome, which I think they figured out, is they were never back. And there was a sense of awe in the congregation, you know, of, I don't know how to put it into words. Do you know what I mean? Okay, I'll just put it, we have sinned. We have sinned. And then, so then God had a surprise for us. There was this man in this part of this valley near San Diego that every small town, I think, has its kind of odd person, rides a bicycle, picks up cans, and then goes to another spot. And this was Bill. And one day at the church, we were up on side of a hill, and I saw him pumping up his bicycle with all his trash. And saw him get off of his bicycle, saw him come towards the church, and I went out, opened the door to meet him. And he said, I've decided I want to be a Lutheran. What do I have to do? And I wasn't sharp enough to say nothing. But Bill wasn't real bright. And no one else was joining, so he was the new member class. And so I sat with him for four different sessions, and he learned nothing. But he was always appreciative. So then the Sunday that Bill joined Shepherd of the Valley Lutheran Church, we just made it the Bill Day. And just welcomed him with open arms, and he came up to the middle to be received as a member of this church. And he had dressed up, he actually had a tie on with one of the collars over the tie and the other under. He wore his best bedroom slippers. And if you can picture this, and then the receiving of that and the people gathering around him to welcome him. And then afterwards, a big cake with his name on it. Bill stayed with us. And we always remember this was a theophany, that we had prayed for a doctor and we got St. Bill. Isn't that amazing? This is a theophany that congregations and groups and communities also can have. Now, question from yesterday, how can special places be set apart as holy spaces when, as Lutherans, we believe, and this is partly from Luther's what's called his nature mysticism, that everything is filled with God, and therefore everything is holy. So we have been cautious about setting apart holy places for holy things, and yet there are special places. In a very unique way, we say they are holy. Now, maybe you could think of some of these that are just done by us and others. Places of memory. I think of this when I pass on the highway across with someone's name. But there's a family that comes to this place and stands there and weeps again as they remember. And this is a holy place. Or the water in the baptismal font, to go there and put water, as we did last night, and make the sign of the cross a special holy place. And aren't there places in the world that we have been that seem to be especially sacred? I think of when we lived in New Mexico, the Church of Sanctuarial up in the mountains, the Pilgrimage Chapel, you know, to walk into that space is holy space. And I don't know, do you have one? Do you have one?
Yeah, I'm thinking of when Jan and I were in Assisi and we walked with people out to the grotto where, not San Damiano, but where Francis lived first with his earliest brothers.
Yeah, Portiuncula.
Yes,
with the big church over the...
Right, and there was a group of young people who were singing, and it took both of us back to places where we had been as youth of the church with groups of people in special places. But so it was kind of an overlay of Francis, our being there, and recalling wonderful moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You ever thought of the word remember?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Actually, it's remembering or reconstitute.
Or recollect.
Recollect. Mm-hmm. And do you remember in confirmation, if you grew up Lutheran, you had the three ways of the sacrament? The true way in the middle, the Lutheran way, and then the one side was the Reformed that said the bread and wine only are remembrance of Christ. And then on the other side were those transubstantiational lists, Catholics. You know, and they thought it actually turned in, and then right in the middle there was an in, under, and through, and we were so proud. And then all of a sudden it dawned on us, remember of the Reformed was another way of saying that Christ is reconstituted in the sacrament. And how did I get on this? The word remember is a holy place and a theophany. Someone have another example?
I don't know if this is quite what you want, because it's not necessarily my holy place, but I am so moved every time we go past the Black Hills, and Bear Butte is a little bit separate, a volcanic promontory that the native people hold very dear in this sacred ground, and we once hiked it, and there were native prayer flags. I grew up in South Dakota. I didn't know that. I learned about prayer flags in Nepal on one of the St. Olaf foreign semesters. I never knew they were in South Dakota, yeah. Right in my own home place.
A whole world.
Yeah, and I was always amazed by that. And yeah. Loved that place.
And Native Americans are the ones we can learn from about sacred sites and sacred places.
Yeah. It's so bare and dry and separate from the hills that everybody thinks is fabulous.
Yeah. So we, everything is holy, but there are those places. Orthodox icon, you know, is called a window into the world of spirit or into the world of God. Then you stand before that icon and then you go through it into another world. Well, that's... I'll move on. One holy place for us are the places where loved ones are buried, the cemetery or where the ashes were spread, and we go back to that place. Mine is Oakland, Nebraska. Has anybody ever heard of that?
Yeah. Really? My grandparents are from Nebraska.
What's that?
My grandparents are from Nebraska.
Are from Nebraska, so that's, yeah. And there's a hill outside the town, one of the largest mountains in Nebraska. And on the top of that hill is a cemetery, and in that cemetery, my great-great-grandfather is buried with his second wife, and my great-grandparents are buried there. And it's a unique sense to be up there. This is where it's all started. The American experience. And, now, my brothers and I keep saying, why don't we just call it a failure and go back to Sweden? But we're not. Okay, well, let's move on to Isaiah. And we're going to look today at Isaiah 20. And you'll notice... the rest of the passage is in the Bible about taking shoes off or sandals off. We're having to push it a little because this is not a dominant theme in the Bible. This is a minor theme, so I've really been digging, digging here. So this is our second one, Isaiah 20. And would... would someone read Isaiah 20, verses 1 through 6? Or, I mean, the whole chapter. 1.
In the year that the commander-in-chief, who was sent by King Sargon of Assyria, came to Ashdod and fought against it and took it, at that time the Lord had spoken to Isaiah, son of Amoz, saying, go and loose the sackcloth from your loins and take your sandals off your feet. And he had done so, walking naked and barefoot. Then the Lord said, just as my servant Isaiah has walked naked and barefoot for 3 years as a sign and a portent against Egypt and Ethiopia, so shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptians as captives and the Ethiopians as exiles, both the young and the old, naked and barefoot, with buttocks uncovered to the shame of Egypt. And they shall be dismayed and confounded because of Ethiopia, their hope, and of Egypt, their boast. In that day, the inhabitants of this coastland will say, see, this is what has happened to those in whom we hoped, and to whom we fled for help and deliverance from the king of Assyria. And we, how shall we escape? Mm-hmm.
I'm sure many of you have read this passage many times. Deep inspiration here. The well is never. Yeah. Did you notice that there's something here about sandals? And also about clothes coming off the prophet Isaiah. One interesting thing to contemporary times. Came to Ashdod and fought against it and took it. This today is the Gaza Strip. So something how current events and the Bible come together. This is the Gaza Strip. And so the story is told, and it's the last years of the 8th century BCE. And Assyrian Sargon, the commander-in-chief of the Assyrian armies of the great empire of that day, has now gone to Ashdod to put down a revolt against Assyrian occupation. And isn't this, is this timely that the Gaza Strip is being controlled by another power and the people of this area rise up against it? And then the revolt was either encouraged or instigated by Egypt. And I get all mixed up about these times and how it all works, because you have Egypt here and Ethiopia, and then Ethiopia and Egypt. And Ethiopia and Egypt were one kingdom at that time, run by Ethiopians in Egypt. I'm sure you have read this often in your study of history. No, just kidding. Then, what is happening here is, what did little countries do at this time of the great empires that were controlling the world and had taken people into their kingdom? Well, a little country would see their hope in a country outside of the empire that they could form an alliance with. And then this larger country, plus their little power that they would add to it, then would drive the Assyrians out of Ashdod, or it's also called the area of the Philistines. So that's what's going on here. And the revolt lasted for 3 years. And during this three-year period, this was the temptation now of Israel. Why don't we join them? Why don't we join? We'll have the backing of Ethiopia and Egypt and these other people. Why don't we join them? Now, because of this temptation, Isaiah the prophet, remember Isaiah was a prophet of Jerusalem. Isaiah was a prophet who knew all of the important people in Jerusalem and had access to them. Isaiah was now deeply, deeply concerned about what would happen if Israel would join a coalition and be destroyed. Now, the background for that in Isaiah would be in Isaiah 2. Isaiah 2. In days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and shall be raised above the hills, and all the nations shall stream to it. Many people shall come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth instruction, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he will judge between the nations, and shall arbitrate for many peoples. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. And nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more." What is the dream of Isaiah here for the nation of Israel?
Peace.
Peace. And how does that peace come? I'll tell you. because I think it's a beautiful picture that this nation of Israel, by keeping the covenant word of Moses, which is a way for a society to live together in peace, by living together in justice and living in righteousness. And then all the other nations around it are built on hierarchical systems of a person on top controlling those on the bottom, and the constant seething for rebellion and war and alliances. We'll finally get tired of it, and they'll look over to Zion and to Jerusalem, and they would say, look how those people live. They live in a way that there are no rich exploiting the poor. They live in a way of peace with each other because they keep the covenant. They live in a way where the poor, the widows, the orphans, and the sojourners are cared for. Now, wouldn't that be a way to live? So the picture that Isaiah has here is that Jerusalem becomes a university. And then he has this vision of all of these nations streaming to Zion, and they're going up to Jerusalem, and this is the reverse of a siege, a military siege, but it's rather the nations surrounding Jerusalem waiting to get into the door to the classroom where they will learn the way of peace and the way of justice and the way of righteousness. And they'll sit in the classrooms and they'll take notes. And then they'll go back to the nations around them and teach. And then the nations will beat their swords into plowshares. And they will not learn war anymore. Now, if you take this as the heart of Isaiah, do you see how Israel, with its king, as a little nation trying to be a big deal like the other nations, trying to form a military military alliance with another nation to take on the big nation. This is very, very seductive to the people. And if you want to learn about how war is seductive, it's, I mentioned yesterday, Chris Hughes's War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. When life doesn't seem that good, or you're bored, or the routine, there's nothing more exciting than war until the reality comes crushing in. So this is where Israel is going, and it's the opposite way of the way of Yahweh. Now, it's been very interesting with, and one needs to be careful here in speaking, but what I've been very interested is the few voices in Israel today and also in the past who have kept Isaiah's vision that we're not here to take over other countries and other people's land and then rule them by force. But we have another mission, and that goes back to Isaiah. And I think, and I haven't studied this enough because it's one of the great leaders, theologians, if it's Heschel, or I just forgot. It's one of those voices was crying out that Israel was never meant to be a nation like other nations, but has another mission, and there are still those voices.
Martin Buber?
Yeah, I think Martin Buber was in that. If anybody wants to study that, then bring me a report. Because there are those voices, and we need to hear them. Now, where am I with this? Oh, we're back to the Isaiah. So now Isaiah receives this word from the Lord, is to take off your sandals. And during this 3-year period, when the war is going, but Israel has not entered into that war yet, but there's a sense of this is the way the nation should go. So they need a sign, and this is what prophets do. It's called, in modern times, it's called street theater, you know, or it's a drama that is put on by the prophetic person, that people will look at that drama, and instead of being told what to do, they'll have an aha. And then, so what he does is takes off his clothes and his shoes, and he just walks around Jerusalem up and down the streets for 3 years. Now, some background on this, that in Israel it was much more shameful to look at a nude person than to be a nude person. Remember the Noah story of the sons of Noah that looked upon his nakedness. And I think there were other examples of this. This is one idea that is part of the prophetic demonstration before Israel. It was to dress as one is dressed in taking off, or when one is taken into captivity. And that is, the winning army will take the defeated soldiers and strip them of everything, and except for a loincloth that covers their front. And then, as we read in Isaiah, their buttocks is showing. And this is very, very humiliating. And this is when you are carried off into slavery, as the winning city cheers and laughs at you and torments you as you're being taken away into slave status. And so now here is Isaiah up and down the streets with maybe his loincloth, maybe completely in the nude, no sandals, to preach the word of the Lord with silent drama. Oh, what do you think of this?
You gotta be there.
Where did that voice come from? Oh, be careful. You gotta be there.
Who knows why this thought flashed in my head, but what a far cry from streaking and mooning. You know, look what happened to nakedness.
Yeah.
It became a countercultural. Well, this is countercultural too, but in a different sense.
In a different sense, yeah.
And this is not only a sign, but it is a portent. That comes, I think, for me, comes from Greek drama, to, you know, the portent in this particular sign.
But say more about a portent. Like, how does that work in Greek?
Yeah, it's an omen of evil to come, of bad things to come. A sign could be for good, too, you know, like an evil rising in the air, you know. But help me think of a portent in English.
Isn't it portending what's going to happen to Israel?
They're
going to be exposed.
And do you think people wanted to see this?
No.
Because why?
Well, you said before, Dan, that it was more shameful to look at someone who was naked than to be naked.
Yeah.
So of course no one wanted to be shamed.
Yeah.
So why do you think Isaiah chose that way?
It was 3 years was quite a commitment.
Well, and if he was also silent, because someone could look at him, how was he going to make an impression?
He made an impression.
I want to know how his onlookers knew what they were supposed to know.
Oh, yeah. Here's my guess, that it would have been common knowledge of how you treated a defeated army. Mm-hmm. And then for a Jewish person who is a prophet to walk up and down the streets dressed as one who is a defeated, I think it would have been fairly clear to people in very uncomfortable day after day of being reminded. Excuse me, one thing that Chris had just said, war is based on myth. Mm-hmm. You know, the myth of glory, the myth that we are right, mm-hmm. The myth of the evil of the other person. Mm-hmm. And then a prophetic figure is a person who in either words or action or drama questions the myth. Does that make sense? And you know, why do we have to get rid of prophets?
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about how uncomfortable a lot of things we see in the city make us, and this brings to mind the people that tend to position themselves at off ramps of freeways or streets that hold out signs day after day, you know, I'm hungry, I need money, I need food, and it makes me, I draw a parallel in my mind to this. Mm-hmm. It's a prophetic voice. I mean, it reminds people that not everyone are well fed, and it's uncomfortable to look at. Mm-hmm.
To meet their eyes.
Yeah, those people would go away. Is that how we sometimes feel? Because they remind us and think of how so many things are set up so we don't have to see. You know, like the gated community or the separation of neighborhoods. Or the tent cities. Mm-hmm. In Seattle area, and it's one of the, I think, the glories of the church. You know, if you ever heard the church being put down for not doing the right thing, and then these churches that take this risk of inviting the tents of the homeless, and how the people rise up. And is the reason they rise up, not because it would be of danger to them, but we don't like to be reminded. And the worst way to be reminded is by visual drama, because that has a way of going over our defenses and getting into our souls and our hearts. Well, Ron.
Yeah, I was just thinking the... If Isaiah was doing that today, some smart entrepreneur, like the ones in Seattle, they called it bumvertising. And this guy wanted to advertise his zip code. So we went up to the beggars at certain places in Seattle and said, would you wear my website underneath your sign? And he would give a certain amount of money, and some would and some wouldn't. And it made the news, and it was called bumvertising. And I think there's this, I only bring that up because what is, for some, a prophetic sort of stance, standing there with their sign, whether you believe them or not, that's not the issue. It's there, they're there. And this one woman, she agreed I would do it. And she said, this is work. This is hard work standing here 8 hours a day. you know, not doing anything, right? For all those who have that work ethic. And I think that's the danger of our times. We can take assassination and change it into, that's what Bonhoeffer did. That's what Pat Robinson is saying about his stupid statement about we should assassinate the president of Venezuela. It's cheaper. And for the sense of commodity and efficiency and all the rest that we all kind of think through all the time, they can advertise that and build upon the very thing that you're talking about as being what would draw us into peace, would draw us into just the opposite. Mm-hmm. And so I think we face a little different danger, and I think it's worth paying attention to naked Isaiah mm-hmm. before somebody puts some smart sign on.
Yeah. Oh. I tell you what happened to Israel after this. The Assyrians crushed Egypt and Ashdod and Ethiopia, and then this was in the year the end of the the last years of the 8th century BC, which would be the last years of the 700s, am I right? Mm-hmm. Anybody else get mixed up on that? Mm-hmm. The last years of the 700s. So then there was the 3 years of the Philistine revolt, and then in Jerusalem, the message of Isaiah continued to be avoid these entangling foreign alliances. And then again, I have to apologize. I'm a little mixed up here in my history. I don't think they defeated Egypt and Ethiopia at this time, but they utterly crushed Ashdod at this time. And so now, after this is all over, the temptation remains for Israel to form an alliance with Egypt and Ethiopia against the Assyrians. And it was in 705 that Hezekiah rebels. The king of Israel seeks Egyptian help and is encouraged by the Ethiopian dynasty in Egypt. And then the armies of Assyria come, and they, first of all, under Sargon, the great general of Assyria, they totally destroy 46 cities of Israel. I'm sure cities meant towns in that time, total destruction. And then they form a siege around Jerusalem. And we have to, it's hard to imagine what it must have been like to have a sieging army around your city from the greatest empire on earth at that time. And when the walls are broken and they come in, then it's total devastation and murder and the rape of women, children. It's utter disaster and destruction. So imagine yourself standing on the walls and seeing this powerful army making their plans for the siege, and the fear that is within you. Then one day they're standing up there and looking, and all of a sudden there's this surprise. The Assyrians are folding up all of their tents, loading up their wagons, and then before the eyes of those watching from the walls of Jerusalem, they see the entire Assyrian army simply pack up and leave. Do you think there were parties? Amazing. Amazing. Now, what do you think they thought was the cause of this? because they didn't have a report. God had saved them. This is a miracle. God has saved us. And it must be the temple in Jerusalem, the house of God. And then now the idea catches on that we'll be eternally safe as long as we have the temple in Jerusalem and we worship God in Jerusalem. What an amazing day this must have been. Now we know from history that what happened is a more important battle that had much more political significance for the Assyrians was calling to them and was much more important for them to be there than in this little two-bit country. We can catch them later, you see. But to the Jewish people now, this was the miracle of all miracles. So then later now, when Babylon is the great empire that has defeated Assyria, when the kings do the same thing, they make alliances with other nations against Babylon, or they refuse to pay the tribute to test Babylon. And one thing about empires is that they have no sense of humor. So then this finally leads to the Babylonian army surrounding Jerusalem. And this time it doesn't work. And then the people become what years before Isaiah had symbolized in his walking without sandals and without clothes up and down the streets of Jerusalem. So that was the beginning then of the Babylonian captivity and exile. Now I want to bring up one idea it comes from some, but the one I've read is from Gene Tucker, who's the Old Testament emeritus at Chandler Emory in Atlanta. Anybody here from Atlanta? Talking about symbolic actions that are deeply rooted in the institution of prophecy. And what happens is there's the possibility that that symbolic action will not only embody the future, but also will set the future into motion. There's always that possibility. What is the possibility? 1% of all symbolic actions. But when it happens in the right time, in the right place in history, it sets, not only symbolizes the future, but sets the future into motion. Think of any examples. I'll start. Rosa Parks. Think of her symbolic action of refusing to get off of her seat in that bus.
Gandhi's march to the sea.
Yeah. Do you know a little more about how? Do you know a little more how it worked?
Well, he had a group of about 79 who were going to march with him because the British prevented the Indian people from using salt in their food or making their own salt, which is very important. And he had already been, starting the spinning. Every Indian who joined him was spinning their own cloth, and of course that was in the face of England's looms, their manufacturing of cloth. It's today's globalization story, you know, how the empire was controlling all of the economic resources of the people. So in this March to the Sea, he started with 79 who had been trained in nonviolence, but others, as they walked, thousands joined him. Mm-hmm. And they got to the sea, and he symbolically knelt down and scooped up a handful of seawater and water and some salt that had dried on the sand. And then everyone started doing the same and making their own salt. And then, of course, the British came and beat them. And, you know, mm-hmm. that was one of the most impressive events in which nonviolence was acted out. They took the blows rather than fighting back, which is, of course. And then Martin Luther King studied Gandhi, and that started his approach to achieving civil rights in this country. So it has, and it's had just a tremendous reverberative effect, rippling effect.
And the civil rights movement, how well they understood symbolism and drama.
But I think here, you know, in asking us to look at Isaiah 2, it seems to me that you have the seeds of nonviolence there. You know, I mean, God will arbitrate. Now, arbitration is far different from using the sword, you know. And, I mean, no one here can fail to notice certain almost literal parallels between this story and our time. I mean, even as far as the locale is concerned. Assyria, it's present day, as I understand it, Iraq and Syria, am I right?
Assyria is Iraq.
It's Iraq, yeah. Mm-hmm. And there are Chaldean Christians from that area, very ancient group of Christians. Mm-hmm. And then we had, you talk about empire, you know, I mean, there are, I don't care to go on, but I'm sure Chris Hedges' book is one good thing to read that points out some of these parallels.
Well, yeah, and there are more and more voices that are saying that in a different way, but still, you know, there is an American empire. Mm-hmm.
You know, that, that's what I'm talking about.
And that's why then you start saying, well, if this is valid, what are the symbolic acts that people of faith can do, or people of justice? You know?
I think of the anti-war movement in our country when the anti-war people, you know, standing up against rows of soldiers. The guns who put the flowers right into the barrel of the guns back in the 60s as a way of representing the contrast between warfare and things of nature. And I also remember watching, as many of us did on television, the Tiananmen Square situation where the young man just stood up in front of the tanks, and here was the forces of the military and a vulnerable young person refusing to move. And that was a great symbolic thing for many of us, of the courage and the confrontation between the powerful and the weak.
When the news started showing Cindy Sheehan, it isn't going to make it, but I was, when I saw it, I said, well, someday there's, or don't I have enough faith that maybe, but she's a person like Rosa Parks, ordinary person, and think of how she has threatened the whole system of, and how the attempt now to discredit her
Who is this person?
Oh, I'm sorry, Cindy. She's the one that has in Crawford, Texas, who's a mother of
son
a
was killed in Iraq.
And she's camped near the president.
That's another example of one person can make
it's a working.
Yeah, you know, one person and you and one never knows because everything in history has to be kind of just right.
Yep.
You know, there were probably many other Martin Luther Kings, but he was there. You know, John Huss was burned at the stake, and Luther was there when everything converged together. And these incidences then really set the future. And so if any time we think we are powerless, we are not. Because it has been these acts of people that have upset the whole systems of the world. And we need to celebrate those. And then, and I think just be faithful. I think Cindy probably wasn't saying, oh, I'm going to start a movement. She just was mad. Angry. Yeah.
You know, that that story hit the same time for those who preach the story of the Canaanite woman coming to wanting mercy from Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a public event. And I don't know if you remember that story, but his disciples are really upset with this woman screaming in public, help my daughter, or help me. Mm-hmm. And it's so striking is, of all the scriptures, Jesus always wins those battles of the words, the mm-hmm. stories, whatever you call those.
Yeah.
He loses this one.
Yeah.
And he loses it big time. And I was following the very story of this woman out there wanting to talk to the Lord, meaning George Bush, and will not get the audience. Because if he did that, simple act of talking, he did one time, but if he were to do it now in the context of how people are looking at publicly, I'm saying publicly, he would be shamed, and so would this whole mess that we're in. And so what Jesus has to do, which is phenomenal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Change his mind. He has to, oh my God, we didn't come for you, lady, or your daughter. Came for the lost sheep of Israel, and that's enough. And I read that, and I just said, oh my God, this woman down there, I don't care if she's an activist, whatever she is. But the point is, the Lord wouldn't go see her. And anybody who's ever tried to deal with big institutions and power folks, you know, how do you get in the door? You know, they send out their representatives always, you know, oh, bless you, Pastor Ron. Yeah, don't bless me. He gets a move. And so I found that story parallel almost unsettling because Jesus lost that one. And then her faith saves her. And I said, well, what kind of faith? She never even went to Sunday school. They didn't even go to confirmation there. They didn't even know the right and the wrong way.
Oh, yeah. No, it's closing time. And I would like to just share this, to remind us of the story of Jesus sending the disciples in to get a hold of the donkey. And then a very, very planned demonstration. And to ride into a city on a donkey was a symbol of the Isaiah way of making peace on this earth. To ride in on a horse was the sign of the way of the empires. And then Jesus rode in to Jerusalem as a sign of a peacemaker, and they couldn't take it. And then if there ever was an event, unexpected event, that actually, I forgot the word that I used, set the future into motion, set the future, was Jesus' death on the cross. and from the cross forgiving enemies. And I don't know, I'll close with this sadness that God is still waiting for us to get it. And that we'd be part of that future that's set into motion by the cross of Jesus. Tomorrow, what are we doing?
Elimelech?
Ruth and Boaz, I think.
Yeah. No, Elimelech.
Oh, yeah, we have to do Elimelech first. Thank you. Tomorrow is Elimelech. Is that on the schedule?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
And we're going to tell them just a beautiful short story of the romance of Ruth and Boaz. So, see you tomorrow.
Thank you.